Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual doubleheader today. James Pogue will report on the New Right, and Anatole Levin will update us on the politics around the war in Ukraine. James Pogue, who was on this show a couple of years ago to talk about the Socialist Rifle Association, has a long and fascinating piece on the newest New Right, a phenomenon we've been studying here on Behind the News. The occasion for the piece was the National Conservatism Conference held in Orlando late last year. If the phrase national conservatism puts you in mind of another movement that had national and ism in its name, well, don't lose that thought. A large figure in this movement is Peter Thiel, a venture capitalist who made a fortune from PayPal, where he displaced another odious billionaire, Elon Musk. In 2003, Thiel founded Palantir, a data company partly funded by InQtel, the CIA's venture capital arm, which is a major contractor not only for the CIA, but also the National Security Agency and the FBI. Not to mention all sorts of other governmental agencies around the world. Despite this intimacy with the national security state, Thiel presents himself as some sort of libertarian, although, as James Pogue will tell us, his politics are a bit fuzzier than that. Blake Masters, whom we talk about as one of the Trump-friendly politicians on Peter Thiel's payroll, is running for Senate in Arizona, a campaign baptized with $10 million from Thiel. Masters has been working with Thiel for over a decade. Here's James Pogue. As I was reading your piece, I thought of William Buckley's mission statement in the first issue of National Review, 1955, saying that the magazine stands athwart history yelling stop at a time when no one is inclined to do so or to have much patience with those who so urge it. Now, he was complaining about a dominant liberal culture of moral relativism at the time. How much does this crew have in common with the people you wrote about?
A lot. And it's hard to characterize exactly how many people are sort of fitting into a tradition of American conservatism and how many people are coming to this from very, very far afield, from ecological back to the land stuff, from tech stuff, from all of these weird corners of the internet that have coalesced around what, I mean, I guess I called the New Right. But certainly, like, amongst the people who I'm sure we'll talk about, like J.D. Vance, there's a version of this that they're, you could almost say they're just simply trying to get conservatism back to a version of itself that got lost in the corporatist, Reaganite, libertarian, hyper-capitalist vision of conservatism. J.D. Vance's favorite thinker, he often says this, is Pat Buchanan.
A Catholic reactionary with Nazi sympathies.
Well, this is the thing, right? I mean, the book that Vance cited to me the first time we met as the thing that kind of shaped his worldview as a young guy was Death of the West. Death of the West is, I think you could say, like an document in forming the worldview that we now call anti-globalism, right? Which shaped a certain portion of the Trump movement. We can debate about how much of that. And it shapes a lot of what this New Right is, right? You know, anti-globalism is something that I have come to notice filtering down throughout the right, even in, you know, I live in a very rural area where nobody's reading a lot of this kind of online stuff. But you're noticing that words that could have come out of the mouth of Marine Le Pen are getting said by county commissioners here and stuff. And Pat Buchanan was kind of the early figure in that, I would say. He was the standard bearer for a long time within the Republican Party.
There's a period where Buchanan and Ralph Nader were having back-channel communications back when Nader was running for president. I want to talk about Vance a little bit, but let's talk about Thiel, who is the money bags behind a lot of this stuff, very influential on a lot of these people. Thiel is sometimes presented as a libertarian, but he's also quite anti-democratic. What do you see is the political philosophy of Peter Thiel? Is there one that you can distill as any kind of coherent political philosophy, or is it all over the place? What about that?
The two big mistakes that people make in trying to analyze the Peter Thiel role in all of this is assuming that he has a coherent political philosophy, one, and two, actually overestimating his role in funding it. He is funding it at the level of politics. He is funding J.D. Vance and Blake Masters, and that's very clear. I tried to be very forthright in the piece that, you know, some of the rumors about Thiel bucks are overstated. Some of these people that people talk about as getting money from Peter Thiel are not. And I tried to be clear about that in the piece. Some people took it to be a dark network. As regards his philosophy, Thiel did start out as libertarian. He was, and I think still is, a member of the Federalist Society. He went to Stanford as a culture warrior, a very sort of mainline Republican culture warrior, with libertarian tendencies, loved Ayn Rand, all of that stuff, all the normal stuff. But over time, Thiel has come, and I think he would say this as forthrightly as anybody, he has come to see corporate and tech power as being limiting to some degree to the human freedom that he loves. Like, he's a big guy. He's all about human freedom. He wants great guys like him to be able to, like, do great inventions and do great works. Something I didn't talk about, but I think is a really interesting window into Peter Thiel's worldview, and it's a strange one, is he went to the National Conservatism Conference, which he helped to fund, and he talked about nationalism, which you would think a hyper-libertarian tech oligarch wouldn't be that into. He talked about nationalism as a corrective to what he called the one-world brain-dead globalist state, and the sort of mindset that he sees emanating from Davos and the bureaucrats of the European Union and the Atlantic Council and these types of people, right? And then he talked about what his vision for victory would be. And he said that he wanted to get America back to a place where we had ticker tape parades for individual greatness. And he offered as his example of who he would throw his first flag waving Hooray for America ticker tape parade to. And it was Satoshi Nakamoto, the guy behind Bitcoin. So it's a very strange world where it's sort of like kind of this mom and apple pie thing and kind of this like very techie, weird underground thing. And they're all coming together right now on the right.
Peter Thiel is a guy who founded a company, Palantir, funded in part by the venture capital arm of the CIA. So this is a very strange kind of individual freedom and anti-statism he's touting.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, and again, like, trying to overstate Thiel's coherence is always going to get you in trouble. Thiel likes to make money, and he likes personally to succeed at things. I'm not 100% certain that Thiel always knows what he's doing. When you talk to Blake Masters, who for a long time ran the what they call the family office of Thiel and who's long been Thiel's very close associate, he will emphasize all the time that a lot of times Thiel doesn't really know what he's doing. He's just trying stuff out. Some of your listeners may remember that Peter Thiel helped to fund this seasteading idea where you're going to found cities and countries out in the ocean where you can have a libertarian paradise ungoverned by countries. And a lot of people sort of took that and went, oh, okay, this is what Peter Thiel is. He's like a hyper end the state libertarian. But a lot of people, I think, would more accurately characterize that as just he had a lot of money and he thought it was interesting and he's going to try it. One of the things that has been compelling to people, and we can talk about whether this is really dangerous and scary or not, but one of the things that has been really compelling to people on the left and attracting people from the left to this new right is a kind of willingness to try very weird things. And Peter Thiel has been, to some degree, the poster boy for that.
All right, let's move on to another star of this crowd, Curtis Yarvin, the former Mencius Moldbug. I guess you could call him one of the intellectual leaders of the crew and an influence on Thiel. Now, from what I've read, his worldview is highly anti-democratic. Is that fair? How would you describe it?
Yeah, Curtis has a line he says that encapsulates it pretty neatly. He says there are two questions. Are we a democracy and should we be democracy? And he says the answer to both of those questions is no. Curtis argues that democracies essentially degrade in power very quickly and that all through the history of the United States, we basically have had an oligarchy or even a sort of monarchical presidency masquerading as a democracy. And that over time, periodically, that has degraded. And then we've sort of reestablished governments. So what Curtis would say now and does say is that we're sort of living in a degraded version of a monarchy that was created around Roosevelt during the New Deal, when you started to have kind of government by these big agencies that could do a lot very quickly. And Curtis liked that. His vision of monarchy is that you're going to have kind of what he calls a constitutional coup. We're going to have someone come in and really reestablish the authority of the executive branch, which he thinks we need to do because as the executive branch has bled out into this vast ecosystem of agencies and regulatory forces and this sort of thing, that the executive branch actually doesn't have power localized in the president. And he wants somebody to come in and take that power.
Which takes us to the ghost of Trump, who is hovering over a lot of this. I mean, what's their relation to this guy? And is January 6th some kind of model of the coup that they had in mind? And that kind of authoritarian executive presidency that Trump wanted to pursue, or you know, Viktor Orban is pursuing in Hungary, is that a model of sorts for them?
Certainly the Orban one is. Orban talks about a non-liberal democracy, you know. Orban did the things that people in this ecosystem are saying really need to be done. He took control of institutions, and he took control of institutions that have power outside of formal government. He put people in media, and I'm not an expert on what happened in Hungary, so I don't want to talk too far afield, but Orban has a lot of power over how the media works. And a lot of people in this world looked at Trump and they did kind of envision him as the possible vessel for this kind of politics that they're talking about. And I think they tend to think he failed partially because of, you know, what people might have heard called the deep state resisting him, but partially because they regard the institutions of American media as a kind of separate power center. And even like Curtis will say, like a branch of government. He calls the New York Times essentially a fourth branch of government. And he thinks that the media went to war with Trump and prevented him from doing the America First stuff. Trump was able to do the stuff that the establishment liked. He was able to do tax cuts and kind of keep things rolling for business and the stock market and that sort of thing. But he wasn't able to do the stuff they really wanted, you know, really slash immigration, pull back the American empire, that kind of stuff. They essentially think that the media went to war to prevent him from doing that. They were serving the interests of the establishment.
There's a left wing of this, we might say, you know, symbolized by Compact magazine, and they talk about a nationalist social democracy. I see the nationalist part. Where is the social democracy part? Do you see that anywhere in these circles?
I've talked at length, largely off the record, with J.D. Vance about this, because it gets very tricky, and because you get into this part he said on the record. But, you know, you get into this problem of they're having to play ball and win elections and appeal to Republican donors, appeal to the traditional power base of this vehicle they're trying to use to reshape American politics, which is the Republican Party. They're trying to take it over, and they're going to have to fight a war from within. They would often poo-poo the criticism that they're not focusing on the social democracy thing because they think they have to solve the power question first. That said, you know, I talked to Blake Masters about this. His main policy proposal that people talk about a lot is that he says, I want to get America back to it being a place where you can raise a family on a single income. And I talked to him about that. And the steps that it would take, the steps that he's envisioning are huge steps. I mean, really like onshoring industrial production on a huge level, really reshaping like how money and power work in America. Some of those things I think people on the left could really agree with. And some of those things I think people on the left might be really excited by, but they're not what people are leading off with. They're not the conversations that people are leading off with. The conversations that people are leading off with, and they will admit this too, are culture war things. They are the nationalism. They are the immigration. They are the Kyle Rittenhouse even. You know, these kind of things. They're using that as their wedge to get in. And I think even they would agree it's a pretty dangerous game to be playing.
Vance, of course, is a popular figure here. He described the U.S. as being in its late Republican phase, small r, like as a republic, not Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
What does he mean by that, and where will this take us? What are the choices as we move past the Republican phase?
So that quote about the late Republican phase came from a podcast interview that was a real gem of a find. But he was describing America essentially as in the late phase of the Roman Republic and awaiting some kind of Caesar figure to come and settle the chaos. And he talked in very, you know, essentially cribbing from Yarvin in some ways, terms about we're going to have people come in and do a debathification program, a de-wokification program, and put, quote, our people in charge. And so he proposed essentially mass layoffs within the federal government to seize the institutions of power, seize the institutions of what he called the administrative state, and turn them into a vehicle for essentially like right-wing culture and right-wing values. And that's sort of something that Viktor Orban has attempted and to some degree succeeded at doing. And you might notice that it kind of has echoes in Florida as well with Ron DeSantis, who's a big hero of these people and probably more of a hero than even Trump at this point.
I'm speaking with James Pogue. Thiel and Vance purport to speak for the despised normies, but they're very anti-democratic. Do they want to give the normies any power, or do they just want to speak for and to them?
This is the thing. I tend to think, at least with Yarvin, that he thinks that the normies just generally never do have power. That it's just the normies don't wield power. Yarvin will talk favorably about aristocracy and unfavorably about oligarchy. And so in the sense that he kind of thinks you need an aristocracy, you need a set of people who are trained and equipped to govern and to lead and to rule, essentially, and to do that very effectively. When you sort of degrade that aristocracy across what he sees as like New York Times reporters and people who work for the State Department and all of these different people who wield a certain small amount of power in the American structure, he thinks that it's so degraded that a sort of large section, a 20% section, not a 5% section of America, has way too much power. I don't know how he thinks the normies can get their views and wishes up to that aristocracy. That's a kind of lacuna in what a lot of these people talk about publicly. It is the big question. It's the big question because a lot of these people who are signing on to this are saying, oh, this would be really great. We need to do something to get America governing again. But I think they're not necessarily paying attention to what that would mean for their own political influence and will.
Now, this takes me back to my days in the Party of the Right at Yale long ago, and my undergraduate indiscretion. But there are two features that really struck me when I was reading the piece. One was that every Party of the Right meeting begins with the current chairman reciting the kings and queens of England from memory. And then the immediate previous chairman recites a bit from Charles I's execution speech, which includes the words, "A subject and a sovereign are clean different things. The people know nothing of government. It is not their business." Now, this is something that would go on within the sanctums of the Party of the Right. I'm not sure they would share this publicly. I get a taste of this about this crowd, too, that they may pretend to be not populist exactly, but, you know, speak on behalf of the people against elites. But in fact, they have a vision of elite rule, or just a different kind of elite from the one that now rules.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's an amazing anecdote. And not to get too far into the esoteric weeds of this, but it's an amazing anecdote because Curtis views the execution of Charles I and the deposition of the Stuart kings of England as kind of like this great moment of fall in Western history. On these podcasts, you will have people as a shorthand say, what we're trying to do is restore the Stuarts. We're trying to restore the Stuart kings, this absolutist kind of monarchical vision of how governance works.
The divisions in the Party of the Right in my day, which was very small because it was the 1970s and, you know, there weren't very many conservatives in those days. But there were divisions between the libertarians and the monarchists. And there was a splinter monarchist party, the Tories, that went off because the monarchists in the Party of the Right weren't monarchist enough. But, you know, it's just really bizarre for me to think that 40-some years later, there is a serious monarchic tendency in American right-wing politics.
Absolutely. They would argue that they've kind of started to solve that division. Obviously, that's not fully true. There's tons of libertarians in America. But I think they've started to win some of these arguments by saying, hey, if you really want liberty, you have to be preserved from chaos, right? So they're saying what the kings used to say, that your liberty will be preserved by my power.
Well, it's liberty for some, though. I mean, it's liberty for the rich and the aristocracy, the talented, or whatever you want to call them, to do their thing, and while the rest of them, the rabble, is kept in line.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how else you characterize monarchy. I mean, my thing is that, you know, I've always been able to reconcile being American and interested in Americana and American history and belief in the project with being a leftist, in part because I tend to think that power should reside in people and it should be leveled as much as possible. And I come from that tendency. That's why I'm a leftist. And so this is just all so strange and in certain ways exactly contrary to anything I've ever believed about how America should work or how power should work in America. And it's very interesting to see how quickly people have come to be fascinated by it and to embrace it.
It also bears a lot of resemblance to Italian elite theory, which I read a bunch of last year. They really do believe in this hierarchy of society, that we need an aristocracy of rulers. Democracy is unsustainable because the people are just too ignorant of what's going on. And that a society whose elites are failing in the task is going to fall apart, and they need to be replaced. As Pareto said, history is a graveyard of aristocracies. I imagine they would like to consign this current elite, this current aristocracy, which is kind of a ridiculous term to apply to the likes of Biden and Harris. I think they would like to consign them to that graveyard. That was, you know, kind of on the pathway to fascism, too. There's some very uncomfortable historical precedents here.
Oh, indeed. And like, you know, I heard Curtis once say probably the most chilling thing he ever said. And it was couched in something very friendly. And he would probably defend it that he's advocating for a peaceful transfer of power. But he talked about how in this new vision of power that he has, groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center were going to get wound up, because he says those are part of the government, too. He regards that as this sort of intelligence gathering arm of the state at this point, like seeking out and identifying and shaming conservatives. And he talks about, you know, kind of retiring those kind of people and washing them away. He says, and I don't think this is true, he says it'll be like the Stasi after East Germany fell. It'll just sort of forget, fold up, and you'll be done with it. That is one version of a transfer of power, but there's also a lot of other ones that are much, much more violent and much crazier. And I think that there's a lot of rosy visions in this world about how easy it's going to be. And I don't think that that's the case.
There seems to be a lot of irony in this world. And is it a having it both ways irony, a form of distancing or psychological defense, a rebirth of 1990s irony, which is one of its leading practitioners told me makes everything okay? Like, what about the irony? Is it a way of making what might be a really scary message go down easier and disowning some responsibility for it? How does it figure in?
To talk sort of more on the cultural aspect, you know, some of the kids who are like less political but are sort of adopting tropes of conservatism and adopting sort of Catholicism and values and things like that, you know, the irony often is covering up like a very deep earnesty, and it's often covering up like a very searching moment for a lot of people who feel like sort of lost in our techie individualist consumerist society. They feel like they don't have any moral grounding. They don't feel like they have any, to use this word, dangerous word, but they don't have any value that shaped their lives. My short answer for where the irony developed was that it was a sort of front to cover up that earnest thing. That said, when you get more into the political realm, you are talking about coups and stuff, and you're talking about monarchy, you're talking about things that could turn violent, that could kill millions of people. And then you kind of laugh it off as, haha, we're going to restore the Stuarts, which, you know, the Stuarts were an incredibly unhappy dynasty that they were not good at ruling, and they all came to terrible ends. So even joking about it that way, it doesn't sound like you're serious. Nobody could really plausibly think that the Stuarts were a good model of government. You kind of hear that stuff and you're like, oh, okay, like maybe they're just kidding. And then sort of third thing, and perhaps it's a matter of interest, is, you know, a lot of these people, you know, they're anti-vax or whatever it is. There's certain things that they can't even literally say on their platforms without getting banned. And so they've adopted irony as this kind of like way to avoid saying trigger words or to avoid getting their words pulled out by journalists like me and quoted in mass media. You have to kind of learn the tropes and the signals and the signs, and then you can start to follow along and you can start to follow the intellectual currents.
There's an anti-Ivy line among a lot of these people, which I thought was funny, since like Hawley and Cruz and DeSantis are all Ivy. Vance went to Yale Law. Thiel has 2 degrees from Stanford, which is an Ivy East version of an Ivy. How do they balance this? Is it just another more irony or the contradictions or what?
Well, I think the way to understand it is to view the world through their lens for a second and see the Ivies as essentially like power bases within, again, this American regime that they're trying to fight, right? So if you are a Soviet and you want to build a faction within the regime to unmake the Soviet Union, you know, you have to accrue a certain amount of power within the Politburo or whatever it is you're going to do before you can take that faction and overthrow, right? And so their argument about why that's not a contradiction would be that they're saying, hey, we're working our way through these institutions. We are gaining the leverage and the power that these institutions offer, but we're resisting from within. The flip side, right, is this kind of like you're using billionaires and elite institutions to dismantle an elite system, a hyper-capitalist system, a system that oppresses ordinary working people much more than it oppresses Yale law grads. And, you know, at that point, and I've asked this question over and over, I mean, you're using the master's tools to take apart the master's house, and that tends to often not work. I've put that to them over and over, and it's something that they will think about, but not necessarily speak to too much, because it kind of undermines the whole project. And so I've tried to get Vance on the record about some of this stuff before, and it's rather difficult.
I sure would love to know what he said to you off the record, but we have our ethics. When I interviewed James Chappell the other week, he'd written mostly about Adrian Vermeule and that kind of reactionary Catholicism. But he said a lot of these post-liberals sound not like full-blown fascists, but the kind of people who, writing in the 1920s, would go full-blown fascist a decade or two later. Is this alarmist from what you've seen?
That's a question that I wrestle with really deeply, because like part of why people will talk to me is that I don't, you know, and I'm often invited to say, okay, is this fascism? Is it not fascism? And my role in this right now is to observe it and describe it so that the people who label stuff can do that. And I understand that makes some people uncomfortable, but there's almost a flick to it, right? Like when you have like the National Conservatism Conference, you're almost daring people to mishear that. And you know, when J.D. Vance, you know, the first time I met him, he talked about my people. And I've said this to him, and I mean it. I'm from the same hometown as him. I'm from, to some degree, the same kind of cultural background as him. And when he says my people, to me, it hits a little different. It hits a little at that thing in your gut that hundreds of years of liberal thought have, to some degree, tried to work out of our politics, this kind of like blooded tribal thing. And they are very much playing in that world. They are very much saying, hey, maybe we went too far in excluding this. And the jump from there to fascism is not far. They would argue that they're very conscious of it and they've learned lessons of history and they're trying to resist that. And that they've tried to learn lessons of history the way leftists have learned from the Soviet Union. They will say that. And to some degree, you have to listen to them. But that doesn't mean that the danger's not there. That doesn't mean that they're not playing in very dangerous water.
At the end of the piece, you say Yarvin asked me what I'd thought of everything. I said it would take a long time for me to figure it out. Have you made any progress towards figuring it out?
I've figured out what I care about. And I've made a lot of contacts and I've met a lot of new people and I've been exposed to a lot of really interesting things. And one of them, and I don't want to quote him because he's in this world and he doesn't like always being characterized as it, but a well-known American writer said to me that after spending a lot of time with a lot of these people, he had come back to a kind of, he used the word Whitmanian, a kind of Walt Whitman vision of what America should be. And like an inclusive, experimental, wild vision of a politics that right now, anybody left and right can agree is not working. And our systems of government are not working. And to kind of like look at some of this stuff as an attempt to experiment with where we could get in a better country. I've also learned where my lines are, and there are some lines and there are some people that I really, really, really make me uncomfortable and who are very intriguing and very interesting, but who I had to kind of just be like, I'm not playing ball with this. That's something that, especially as this gets bigger and as our country grows more chaotic, we're all going to have to face, I think.
I presume you don't want to name any names there, though.
I'd rather not. I have my sources, you know, and I have to kind of preserve my ability to talk to people, you know.
That was James Pogue. His article on the latest iteration of the New Right is on the Vanity Fair website. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was the entirety of Charles Ives' setting of some lines from Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, performed by Eric Trudell and Ryan McPherson. Who goes there hankering gross, mystical nude? Always an apt question. Next, a look at the very opposite of that Whitmanian vision of a democratic country, the war in Ukraine, which is rapidly evolving into a proxy war with Russia. If it didn't start that way, it's getting more like one every day. I thought it'd be good to get an update from Anatole Levin, a fellow at the Quincy Institute, to follow up on his appearance on this show in early March. On Wednesday, the New York Times reported that the U.S. is helping Ukraine target Russian generals for death, a very serious escalation of this conflict. This interview was recorded on Monday, May 2nd, before we learned this distressing news, so I asked Levin for a comment. As it happened, he just finished writing something on the topic. Here's some of what he has to say. The news that the United States is providing real-time intelligence to the Ukrainian army with the specific purpose of killing Russian generals brings America a long step closer to actual war with Russia. This also means a risk of nuclear war that is now greater than it ever has been, even perhaps during the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Biden administration and the U.S. establishment need to ask themselves just one question. If the position were reversed, how would America react to a third country deliberately helping to kill U.S. commanders? Let us never forget that the risk we are talking about here is the complete destruction of the United States, the deaths of hundreds of millions of Americans and billions of others, and the destruction of civilization. The attacks of 9/11 created intense and greatly exaggerated fears of terrorist attacks in America using weapons of mass destruction. Yet the present far greater nuclear threat in plain sight is being treated by most of our political classes with criminal complacency. That's the end of the quote from Levin, and now here he is. We've heard an awful lot of talk coming out of the U.S. government that scares me. We hear about Austin talking about weakening Russia. Pelosi's talk of a wide victory, which is the lead story in the print edition of the Times, the New York Times this morning. She's talking about the strongest possible response. Do you have any sense of what they mean by this? And then, is it strategically wise? But let's first parse their meaning here.
It seems to me that the U.S. government is now aiming for a kind of confrontation with Russia reminiscent of the first couple of decades of the Cold War, but in a much more dangerous way, because this is now going to be proxy war, not just in the rest of the world where interests were secondary, but in Europe. And that, of course, was something that every US president from Truman through to Reagan was very careful to avoid. So they're going to do their utmost to wreck Russia economically. The two most dangerous things are, one, it looks very much as if they're going to help Ukraine not just to defend itself, which Ukraine has done, you know, very successfully and very bravely, of course, with Western assistance. But that is a very different matter from what one's now hearing, which is helping Ukraine to achieve a complete victory. And then you have people defining complete victory as driving Russia out of all the territory that it's held since 2014. That includes Crimea. Well, at that point, all the possibilities are bad, frankly. Ukraine could lose. You know, launching an offensive against dug-in Russian positions with heavy firepower is a very different matter from, you know, defending cities against Russian attack. Or this could turn into an unending stalemate, but with flare-ups of fighting, every one of which will bring with it, you know, new risks of wider conflict. Then precisely the conflict could spread. There are already signs it may be spreading to Moldova. There's every temptation now for Georgia to attack Russia to try to recover its lost territories, for Azerbaijan to attack with Turkish backing to try to recover Nagorno-Karabakh. So then war will engulf the Caucasus again. And finally, of course, there is the possibility that with massive Western military help, Ukraine could actually start winning. Well, I mean, faced with outright defeat and the consequent fall of the Putin administration, there would obviously be, I mean, a very strong temptation in Moscow to try to escalate, start firing missiles into Poland at NATO supply lines in an effort to terrify the Europeans, particularly, into backing off and seeking a peace agreement. So all of this seems to me extremely dangerous.
Putin, listening to this kind of discourse, what incentive would he have to pull back, just encouraging maximum response?
It seems to me that there is a possibility that once Russia has conquered the whole of the Donbass, assuming, of course, that it can even do that, because given the Russian military's performance so far, even that isn't certain. But I think that it's possible that having conquered the whole of the Donbass, that Putin might stop and offer a ceasefire and peace negotiations, for the simple reason that it really does appear that Russian casualties have been enormous, and they have had so much difficulty and lost so much, and also of course had to cause so much destruction, only in order to capture one medium-sized city, Mariupol. I mean, at that point, you have to ask whether it's actually feasible for Russia to go on and aim to capture much bigger parts of Ukraine.
But then wouldn't the use of nuclear weapons then enter the calculus?
No, I don't think so, because not at that point, because that would escalate things. It would, I mean, it would turn the whole world against Russia. And also, what's the point of inheriting a nuclear wasteland? No, I think nuclear weapons would be used as the last resort if Russia was losing. The point is that Putin needs to be able to present this disaster, and you know, and it has been a disaster for Russia, this war, but he needs to be able to pretend to the Russian people that it's some kind of success. So having failed to capture Kiev, having failed to overthrow the Ukrainian government, he's now trying to capture the whole of the Donbass. And, well, we'll have to see. I mean, nobody can say for sure what he'll do, but I think there is a possibility that at that point the Russians will stop. And then to some extent the ball will be in our court and that of the Ukrainians. Do we accept a ceasefire and negotiations, or do we back Ukrainian counterattacks?
All this extreme talk coming out of the U.S. government, assuming it's not just opposed, but they actually mean what they're saying, would they actually accept negotiations at this point, do you think? Or are they just so deeply invested in the idea of bleeding Russia to death that they would reject any negotiation offer as a ploy?
I don't know. I mean, the latest statements, obviously, by Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin and others suggest that, no, that precisely they would reject negotiations and go on. But, you know, there are more moderate voices in the administration, including the former ambassador to Moscow, now head of the CIA, William Burns. So I don't know that it's the done deal yet. We'll have to see, just as we'll have to see what Russia itself does. Things are at the moment still pretty open.
Why is the Russian military doing so badly? Are these reports accurate? You know, and we're getting very few reports on what's happening on the Ukrainian side, but are these reports about Russian casualties accurate? And if so, why are they doing so badly?
Nobody can say for sure, and obviously you couldn't believe either Ukrainian or NATO figures, but I think what is a very strong indication is the number of Russian senior officers who've been killed. And we know that they must have been killed because the Ukrainians claimed that they were killed. And if they hadn't been, the Russians would have produced them, you know, in order to laugh at the Ukrainians and say, ha, 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 here's more lying Ukrainian propaganda. So they must be dead or badly wounded. Well, I mean, to lose that many generals indicates both, you know, obviously a very high rate of general casualties, but also very poor morale among the soldiers, because, you know, generals don't lead from the front in this way unless they've really got to encourage their troops. So, yes, I mean, and also, I mean, the number of destroyed Russian vehicles that we've seen around Kiev. So, yes, I do believe that, I mean, Russian casualties have been huge. The reasons for it, well, a number of things. I mean, one, obviously, Russian strategy was absurd. They attacked from six different directions simultaneously. That left them too weak everywhere. They basically gambled everything, well, actually not everything, only 50% of their forces on capturing Kiev quickly and failed to do so. Then morale appears to be low for whatever reason, whether it's, you know, that ordinary Russian soldiers are profoundly fed up with the corruption of the Putin regime. I always remember my mother, who was an ambulance driver with the British Army in North Africa during the Second World War. She got very cross when people said that the Italians had been cowards, and she always asked, look, would you have wanted to die for Mussolini? So, you know, you can ask her, why would any sensible Russian soldier want to die for Putin, for God's sake? So I think, you know, there's that. Then the Ukrainians have fought very well, very bravely, with tremendous resilience and great skill. And, of course, they've also had a very large number of Western weapons, and very much the kind of weapons they needed for the sort of defensive urban warfare that they had to fight. That's one reason why one has to ask oneself if they will do as well if they have to launch major counterattacks.
Almost 40 years ago, Andrew Coburn published a book, The Threat, which argued that our idea of the Soviet military's prowess was greatly exaggerated. It was actually a poorly equipped institution with very low morale. Are we reliving that experience and discovering that the Russian threat has been greatly exaggerated?
Well, I think that we are. And I mean, one of the fascinating things is that just as during the Cold War, the tremendous strength of the Soviet military and its allies were talked up not just obviously by the Soviet Union itself, but also of course by NATO and the US military industrial complex for very, very good reasons of their own. There were absurd things during the Cold War. NATO calculations of Soviet forces in Eastern Europe included the calculation that the Polish army, the Poles, would fight ferociously for the sake of Russia in order to conquer Western Europe. I mean, you know, nonsensical stuff. Well, it's very interesting that now, if you read and listen to some of the Western military pundits, they're also saying, oh, you know, we can't judge from this, you know, Russian failure so far, that, you know, that actually Russia is not still a very, very strong military force and threat to NATO. Well, I mean, you don't have to be a genius to think that probably military contracts, you know, and the influence of Raytheon and Boeing have something to do with that.
Yes. But now, underlying a lot of the war parties' thinking seems to be that Putin is essentially Hitler. And you wrote in the piece, the most recent piece for Quincy, that if Russia cannot capture cities less than 20 miles from Russia's own border, the idea of an attack on NATO is ludicrous. The real hardcore warriors would view this as appeasement, because Hitler, we have to stop Hitler before it's too late. Yeah, what about that? The idea that by talking down Russian military strength, you're really underestimating the risk of this reincarnation of Hitler.
Well, I don't think anyone ever accused the German army in the first 4 years of the Second World War of not being able to capture cities 20 miles from Germany's border. I've heard many things said about Nazi Germany, but not that. I mean, look, I'm just going by the evidence of our own eyes. You know, Russia was defeated outside Kiev by the Ukrainians and had to evacuate northern Ukraine. It hasn't yet managed even to conquer the whole of the Donbass. It took 2 months to conquer Mariupol. Well, what is this nonsense about Russia invading NATO? It's just, you know, I mean, one must base one's views and analysis on, I'm sorry, I say must, that's naive of me, one should base one's analysis on some kind of evidence. And sorry, but that's the evidence.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin. You mentioned going back to the Cold War precedent of containment versus rollback. Remind us of that historical precedent and what it says for us at the present moment.
Well, the rollback school, and actually the Republican Party, for which Eisenhower was elected in 1952, was at the time dedicated to this, believed that the America should encourage anti-communist and anti-Soviet revolts in Eastern Europe, and then when they occurred, should back them with military force, with the U.S. Army. But George Kennan and then Eisenhower, who had a much, of course, greater sense of military reality as the man who led the Allies in the Second World War, argued basically that this was far too dangerous, that it ran an extremely serious risk of escalating towards full-scale nuclear war and essentially the destruction of humanity. And the thing to do was to contain the Soviet Union, maintain very strong defenses so that the Soviet Union could not expand further in Europe, you know, and defend key U.S. positions elsewhere in the world, by which Kennan did not include Vietnam, for example, or Angola or wherever, and basically wait for the oppression and also the economic insanity of the Soviet Union and Soviet communism to lead the Soviet system to collapse of its own accord, which is eventually what did happen. Really, you know, don't believe that it was Star Wars or Afghanistan that brought down the Soviet Union. What brought down the Soviet Union was the fact that the Soviet Union, Soviet communism, did not work. And it was perfectly obvious by the end that compared to the Western system, they didn't work. But from that point of view, you know, the Cold War was won when the Soviet Union and East Germany built the Berlin Wall. Because, of course, the Berlin Wall was not built to stop West Germans invading East Germany. It was to stop East Germans running away to a better life in the West. That was when the Soviet Union basically acknowledged failure. But unfortunately, the Cold War had to go on for another almost 30 years before that really settled in.
What about the long-term risks of humiliating Russia? I mean, to some degree, Putin himself is a product of our first round of that in the 90s, but if we humiliate Russia even more deeply this time around, is there some kind of risk of really creating a Hitler?
Putin has already become much more repressive. The Russian state and Russian society has become much more totalitarian. Russian domestic propaganda has become far more chauvinist and hysterical as a result of this war. So this, you know, this is already happening. And a long row of not liberal oppositionists, but liberals who, you know, are also patriots and supported the Russian state and even and previously supported Putin have been silenced or driven into exile. Yeah, I mean, this is already very much happening. Of course, the greatest risk for the West is if Russia, after this, seeks in much more radical and dangerous ways to undermine America elsewhere in the world. Now, Russia's capabilities to do that are pretty limited, but, you know, the Middle East is an eternal powder keg. If the Iran nuclear talks fail, then Russia is in a position to strengthen Iran militarily very strongly. And, of course, in the end, there is, but I think that's more or less an inevitability by now, Russia and China forming a really strong anti-American bloc.
What about that the possibilities of that Russia-China alliance? Could it develop? What common interests would they have other than being not American?
Well, I think that's what limits it, because, you know, although the Chinese obviously have a tremendous interest in Russia becoming dependent on them, you know, the Chinese, whatever they may say in Washington, actually the Chinese have been very cautious over Ukraine. They didn't vote against Russia, but they didn't vote for Russia. They haven't sent military supplies to help Russia. They will, of course, buy Russian oil and gas. And above all, there is absolutely no question of China going to war for Russia in Ukraine. China, by the way, never recognized the Russian annexation of Crimea either. I mean, similarly, I think there's any chance at all, unless Russia becomes absolutely subjugated to China, that Russia would ever go to war with America for the sake of China conquering Taiwan. So I don't think this will be a full military alliance, but I think you will see closer and closer cooperation in every way, including economic cooperation, but with, you know, China absolutely as the dominant partner.
What do you make of the argument that the sanctions, while powerful in the short term, are really going to undermine the dollar's international role over the longer term and thereby undermine American power?
Well, we'll have to see. But, I mean, certainly China, having seen what America has been able to do to Russia, is, I mean, you can see them already doing this, thinking more and more intensely about how to set up systems of their own or dominated by China that are insulated against this kind of American seizure or American pressure. So I think that's, I mean, that was happening to a degree already, but I think this has given it the most tremendous boost.
A long-term settlement would seem to involve some kind of pledge of Ukrainian neutrality, maybe giving up a couple pieces of the country to Russia and hoping for some kind of equilibrium out of that. I mean, is that a reasonable foundation upon which to build some kind of lasting settlement? What do you think of that?
Well, I think so. And the Ukrainian government actually offered what for me were very reasonable peace terms at the end of March. Yeah, I mean, a treaty of neutrality with guarantees for Ukrainian sovereignty. Incidentally, guarantees from NATO, which NATO is not prepared to give, which really exposes the West's hypocrisy in all this. And basically to try to turn the territorial issues into a version of Cyprus. You know, Turkey invaded Cyprus in the 1970s, carved out a Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, and for the next, God, I don't know, 48 years, there have been negotiations over the status of Northern Cyprus, but it hasn't led to another full-scale war. And by the way, it didn't stop Southern Cyprus or the Republic of Cyprus from joining the European Union. So in many ways, this is a very attractive model for Ukraine. The problem is, though, that the Ukrainians, completely understandably, insist on Russia withdrawing from all the territory it has occupied since the beginning of this war. Russia, on the other hand, has recognized those blasted Donbass republics on the entire territory of the Donbass, and Russia hasn't even managed to conquer the whole territory of the Donbass yet. So I fear that this could be, you know, one of these sticking points which, is, of course, in objective terms, a ridiculous sticking point, because the amount of territory concerned is, you know, it's very small. There's just one major city, Mariupol, and so forth. But the diplomatic and emotional and political positions on both sides will be so entrenched that there can be no compromise.
And finally, you conclude the piece by asking, have we really learned nothing from history? Have we ever?
Well, I think that's right, alas. I don't think that we do, because, you know, some of the parallels with the early Cold War are very, very close. So, too, are the lessons, of course, of making security commitments, you know, that you have no intention of actually keeping. So, too, are the dangers of demonizing your enemies. Now, sometimes, of course, the enemies really are demons. But, you know, as Kennan pointed out, Stalin was certainly a demon, far more of a demon than Putin. But there was an intelligent and prudent and a stupid and reckless way of dealing with Stalin. And there is an intelligent and prudent way of dealing with Putin that does not, you know, involve surrendering Ukraine. Because something I think that we really, really do need to recognize is that when it comes to the most important issue, which is the independence of Ukraine, Ukraine's path towards the West, and Ukrainian sovereignty over four-fifths of Ukraine, the Ukrainians, with our backing, have already won. They've won. You know, the Russian attempt to capture Kiev, overthrow the Ukrainian government, and turn Ukraine into a satellite state was defeated. And as far as I can see, it can't be revived. I mean, Russia is just not strong enough to do that. That is a tremendous victory. And I think, you know, we should recognize that. But that also means having won the most important victory, we shouldn't you know, chance our arm by going for a total victory over Russia.
That was Anatole Levin, a fellow at the Quincy Institute. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Dmitri Shostakovich's Fugue No. 7, performed by Vladimir Ashkenazy. Till next week, bye.